Good morning, this is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. As the national debate over gun control in the United States gains momentum, the National Rifle Association has been noticeably silent. 4 days after a gunman killed 20 students and 6 staff at Sandy Hook Primary, students at other schools in the Connecticut community of Newtown have returned to class. Meanwhile, in Washington, family members and victims of mass shootings have gathered on Capitol Hill, calling on Congress and the White House to address gun violence. From Washington, Kim Landis reports.
Since the Sandy Hook Primary School massacre, the National Rifle Association has been silent. No public comments, nothing from its Twitter account, and a Facebook page that's suspended. But the public and media campaigns from gun control advocates are in full swing.
My son Alex Teves was killed in the Aurora Theater shooting.
Year-old Jonathan Blunk, who was killed in the Aurora Theater.
Our daughter. Each day since the primary school shootings, other families who've been devastated by gun violence have been speaking out and calling for change. John Woods was a student at Virginia Tech in 2007 when a gunman killed 32 people, including his girlfriend Maxine Turner.
I'd like to see some serious change, and not just a token gesture like the changes to the background check system, the small changes that they made in 2007 after Virginia Tech. It's hard to be optimistic after Friday, but I'm more hopeful now than I have been since 2007.
President Barack Obama has directed cabinet members to come up with ideas and policies to curb gun violence, including reinstating a ban on assault rifles. But as those tentative steps are made, there's still fear about the political influence of the NRA. Dr. Scott Melzer is an associate professor of sociology at Albion University in Michigan, and he's the author of a book, Gun Crusaders, the NRA's Culture War. He's not surprised the NRA is silent for now.
I think the NRA will appear callous if it responds to this tragedy by coming out immediately and, you know, offering its standard argument of guns don't kill people, people kill people.
But Dr. Melzer says after Virginia Tech, which was America's worst mass school shooting, the NRA did not stay silent and inactive for long. And he's certain it'll endeavour to make sure the proposed bans on assault weapons and high-capacity ammunition clips fail.
Honestly, I'll be surprised to see Republicans, as well as many Democrats in rural and conservative districts or states, stepping up and voting for those pieces of gun control legislation.
John Woods is more optimistic that the power of the NRA has waned.
There's not a lot of evidence that the National Rifle Association is as powerful as the media makes them out to be.
A sporting goods chain says it's suspending sales of modern rifles nationwide because of the school shooting, and a US private equity firm is selling its stake in the maker of the Bushmaster AR-15, the weapon used by the gunman. Cerebus Capital Management says it does not want to be drawn into the national debate about gun control. This is Kim Landers in Washington for AM.
The opposition leader, Tony Abbott, says he hasn't yet read the federal court judgment which threw out the sexual harassment case against the former Speaker, Peter Slipper. For months, the federal opposition leader questioned the Prime Minister's judgment for installing Mr. Slipper in the job. Despite his interest in the case, Mr. Abbott says he hasn't had time to read the legal judgment because he's been overseas visiting Afghanistan and the UK. With more, here's Chief Political Correspondent Sabra Lane.
A week ago today, Justice Stephen Rares threw out the court case against the former Speaker, Peter Slipper. In a damning judgment, the justice found to allow the case to continue would have been an abuse of the court process. Justice Rares was scathing too of those at the centre of the case. He found that James Ashby, the man who made the claims against Mr. Slipper, acted in combination with the former Howard Government Minister Mel Brough to advance the interests of the LNP and Mr. Brough in bringing the case to court. In London overnight, Mr. Abbott was asked if that was a damning assessment for Mr. Brough.
Look, I haven't read it. I am confident that he has acted rightly at all times.
And why haven't you read that judgment?
Because I am doing very important things for the people of Australia here in this country right now.
Contrast that with the morning the Peter Slipper sex allegations broke in April. Mr Abbott's office sent out a media release at 9:17 that morning, calling the allegations tawdry. The release said that Mr Slipper should stand aside while the allegations were dealt with by the courts. Despite the court findings against Mr Brough, the opposition leader says the former minister will continue to be the LNP's candidate in Fisher at the next election, which is Mr Slipper's electorate. The former speaker is yet to say whether he'll stand again.
Mal is a friend of mine. Mal was a colleague of mine. I look forward to having Mal as a colleague of mine again. He's been pre-selected by the Liberal National Party. I look forward to campaigning with him. I look forward to winning the seat.
During the past week, Mr Abbott's been overseas and not subject to the usual media scrutiny he has. On Friday, the Prime Minister claimed the Leader of the Opposition was insulting the Australian people's intelligence about the case and that he was using, quote, weasel words to avoid answering simple questions about it, like, what does Mr Abbott mean when he says he has no specific knowledge of the case? Mr Abbott was pressed about that overnight.
Does this suggest you had some knowledge?
Look, the fact is that there were always all sorts of rumours swirling around about Mr Slipper. As I've said before, those rumours intensified in the time leading up to the publication of all of that material. I had no specific knowledge of any of this until I read it in the newspaper.
Mr Abbott says the case won't go away, as the Prime Minister must answer questions about why she installed Mr Slipper as Speaker. But it will keep haunting Mr Abbott and Mr Brough too, especially Mr Brough, as he initially denied any involvement in the case, when the court ruling shows that was far from accurate.
Chief Political Correspondent Sabra Lane. The Japanese whaling fleet hasn't even left port, but it's already had a win against the Sea Shepherd Group. A US court has placed an injunction on the anti-whaling activists, saying the Sea Shepherd can't attack or get closer than 450 metres to the Japanese fleet. The captain of the Sea Shepherd, Paul Watson, isn't saying if he'll comply, but an international law expert says the activists don't have to obey the court order. Felicity Ogilvie reports.
The US Court of Appeals has ordered the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society to keep its distance from the Japanese whaling fleet. The Japanese have won an injunction that prevents the anti-whaling activists from attacking or getting closer than 500 yards, that's 450 metres, to the whalers. But it's unclear if the Sea Shepherd's captain, Paul Watson, will comply.
Our objective is to make sure that no whales are killed, and we'll go about that the same way we have over the last 8 years, non-violently and legally.
And how do you intend to do that? Do you intend to get closer than 500 yards to the Japanese whaling fleet?
Well, you know, we never go into details on how we're going to do it. Over the last 2 years, we've been very successful. We've got the Japanese quite upset about that. So they're spending some $30 million coming after us with an army of lawyers.
Glenn Inwood is a spokesman for the Japanese Institute of Cetacean Research, the group that appealed to the US court.
Over the years, the ICR and the wider Japanese bureaucracy have been putting in place a number of stepping stones to close the net around this group, and particularly their leader, Paul Watson, who is currently a fugitive evading the law and running from the international police who want him for committing crimes at sea. This is just another part of the case against him that's being built.
But Mr Inwood can't say if the injunction will work. An international law expert from the Australian National University doesn't think that the US injunction can be enforced in international waters. But Professor Don Rothwell says Sea Shepherd's fundraising activities could be affected back in the USA.
It cannot be subject to enforcement in the waters of the Southern Ocean. It's only an order that would be subject to enforcement by US courts. But most importantly, because Sea Shepherd is incorporated in the US state of Washington, Sea Shepherd could be held in contempt of court and could be subject to other proceedings if Sea Shepherd fails to abide by this order of the US court.
What other proceedings could affect Sea Shepherd? Could this affect fundraising for the organisation? Why would the Japanese take this approach?
Well, the Japanese would have taken this approach primarily to secure an order against the heart of Sea Shepherd's corporate and fundraising activities in the United States. So it's really seeking to target the corporate and financial activities of Sea Shepherd.
The Sea Shepherd Group is spending millions of dollars on its anti-whaling campaign and has sent four ships to the Southern Ocean to stop the Japanese.
Felicity Ogilvy reporting. And you're listening to AM Around Australia, where it's 20 minutes past 7. To follow us on Twitter, just search for AM World Today PM. Australia's rapidly ageing population is expected to present a lot of problems over the next couple of decades, and it seems many people are not prepared for it. The problems include a loss of skills and an erosion of the taxpayer base as the baby boomer generation drops out of the workforce, and then there's the huge pressure they'll put on care facilities and hospitals. As Martin Cudahy reports, a new study aims to change the way Australia cares for the elderly, whose health takes a turn for the worse.
When he first got sick, the last thing Arthur Mentor expected was cancer.
When I first got it, I thought I had the flu. Well, which I did have the flu, but it turned out to be this. And I just had no energy. I just felt drained.
The 71-year-old is from Warwick in southern Queensland, and his hearing has been affected by the chemotherapy.
Everybody come in that talk quietly, yeah. They're very quiet. I've got to ask them a couple of times, but even when my partner comes in and she talks quite, I got asked her three or four times what she said there.
Dr. Ellen Burkett is an emergency physician at Brisbane's Princess Alexandra Hospital. She says treating each elderly patient often presents an individual challenge.
Older people not only have more severe illness when they come to us, they come to us with their list of other health problems that may not be related to their presenting illness, but that we term comorbidities. And essentially this leads to a complex pattern of illness.
Arthur Mentor can't fault the medical care he's received at the same hospital.
I didn't know what it was going to be all about or where they're going to start or anything else, but anyway, they did it and got it all under control. So everything's fine.
At the moment, there is no standard checklist or set of procedures for dealing with older patients when they go to emergency departments. So the Queensland Emergency Medicine Research Foundation is paying for a study that's looking at deficiencies in how elderly patients are treated. It's a joint investigation between the University of Queensland and Harvard University.
The evidence we have to date is that the numbers of elderly presenting to our emergency departments has markedly increased. That's expected to be much larger in terms of the increase, particularly in the oldest old group, so those who are aged over 80 years of age.
The researchers are looking at 8 emergency departments across Australia. They will then develop a set of tools to measure the quality of care, sort of like a checklist.
The goal that we have in our research is to basically define indicators of care that truly reflect quality and that are feasible for us to measure.
Arthur Mentor was still working and due to retire in a little over a week, but his priorities have changed. Now he's hoping to be out of hospital and home in time for Christmas.
We got any hope, but I'm not going to bank on it, but I am going to get over this. The doctor said there's a 70% cure and 25% in remission. But I said to a doctor the other day about it, I said, am I in a 70% cure? And he said, yeah. It's all right there.
71-year-old cancer patient Arthur Mentor ending Martin Cudahy's report. NASA has successfully crashed 2 spacecraft into the surface of the moon. It brings to an end a research project aimed at learning more about how the moon was formed and the thickness of its crust. Michael Vincent reports.
The 2 washing machine-sized spacecraft were called Ebb and Flow, and they flew in formation right to the end. But their final descent was tricky. First, their remaining fuel had to be burnt, and they had to stay on a controlled trajectory at a speed which reached more than 6,000 kilometres an hour. No one at NASA wanted to hit the Apollo landings or other historically important places by accident. Project leader David Lehman.
We picked this site to make sure that we did not hit the historic sites, the heritage historic sites, and we wanted to get good tracking data before we impacted. And so it turns out that this mountain in the 75 degrees north latitude is where it fell out, where we're going to hit.
The two spacecraft were launched in September last year on a mission to map the gravitational field of the lunar surface. It was called the GRAIL Project, Gravity Recovery and Interior Laboratory. GRAIL Principal Investigator Maria Zuba.
We've determined the thickness of the lunar crust. Finally, we have a crustal thickness model of the moon globally that matches the point measurements that have come from Apollo seismics. And this shows us that the moon's crust is actually much thinner than we thought before.
That will provide a wealth of knowledge for scientists. Fred Watson is the astronomer in charge of the Australian Astronomical Observatory.
It potentially can tell us a lot about the way the solar system, the planets of the solar system were put together. And one reason for that is that unlike the Earth, which has active plate tectonics taking place as we speak, shifting the surface around and actually covering up a lot of the early history, unlike the Earth, the Moon is really a fossil of a period when the solar system was a much more turbulent place than it is now. And so studying it actually helps us to understand what conditions were like in that early solar system.
NASA is hoping the crash site will be photographed by the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. It's already been dedicated to Sally Ride, the first American woman in space who died earlier this year. Fred Watson.
It's one of these things that I think is always a kind of poignant reminder of some of the pioneers of spaceflight who are no longer with us. There's a whole raft of examples of exactly this kind of thing. For example, the New Horizons spacecraft, which is currently on its way to Pluto, carries an ounce of the ashes of Pluto's discoverer, Clyde Tombaugh, who died in the 90s. And I actually think it's rather a good way of commemorating those pioneers that we owe so much of our knowledge to.
The astronomer in charge of the Australian Astronomical Observatory, Fred Watson. Michael Vincent, the reporter. Coco, the red cloud kelpie who starred in the film Red Dog, has died from heart disease at the relatively young age of 7. Coco's owner and producer of Red Dog, Nelson Wass, says he's lost his best mate. The movie tells the story of a dog which roamed about the Pilbara region of Western Australia in the 1970s. David Webber's report begins with an excerpt from the film.
It's not just any dog in there, you know.
No?
Oh, no, he's a famous dog. He's probably the most famous dog in all Australia. Red Dog.
Coco was born to breeders Carol and Len Hobday in Victoria. Carol Hobday says she was told of his death by the film's producer, Nelson Wass.
He told me that he'd just lost Coco. He was absolutely distraught. I felt so, so for him.
And how are you feeling now?
Oh, devastated. I can't think much about it. I had a look and I put a message for Nelson onto his Facebook because that was the only way I could do anything.
Can you just explain for me your experience, your personal experience with Coco?
He was a dog that was a little bit different to the rest because he was the first to do everything and he made sure the others got out of his way so he could do it. And he was a dog that loved to show before I met Luke Hura.
Luke Hura was the trainer who was looking for a dog to star in Red Dog.
That's right, yes. We met him at a dog show. I said, but I do have one at home that you could take for the movie, but I'll have him back because he's our dog.
Carol Hobday says she and her husband eventually allowed Nelson Wass to take Coco as a pet because they liked the producer so much. Mrs. Hobday says she loved the film.
Oh, absolutely the best thing I've seen. The best thing since sliced bread. I love the way they put the story over as a family movie.
How will you remember him?
How will I remember him? I'll remember him as my dog. The dog that loved to chew my bracelet. Loved to chew my necklace and any piece of metal he could, whether it be a button or a piece of jewellery. Most affectionate dog. A dog that never forgot me. Every time I went to visit, I got the same response from him. I got the same reaction every time. He loved me to pieces. It was lovely. So I just remember him as a wonderful, wonderful dog.
To the financial markets now, and the Dow Jones in afternoon trade was up 99 points, the NASDAQ up 39. The dollar is a little weaker. It's currently buying 105.2 US cents, 88.6 Japanese yen, and 79.6 euro cents. I'm Tony Easley. Thanks for your company, and that's AM for today.